Welcome to Tales of Northern Michigan's Past. I'm your host, Christopher Struble. And joining me today is author, historian, and friend, John Cohasey, who calls Pontiac, Michigan his home. John and I first met, I believe, in 2010 when he came to Petoskey to interview me for an article he was writing on Hemingway's time in Northern Michigan, a subject he was already quite well versed in. What I thought would be a short, possibly hour-long interview turned into an all-afternoon affair as we continued to touch upon numerous topics that we both have great interest in, including music. As John is a very prolific guitar player, especially fingerstyle Delta blues, I would say, and all of the history that surrounds many genres of both Americana music as well as from across the pond. John has written several books. He may be best known for his work Hemingway and Pound, A Most Unusual Friendship, and my personal favorite, American Rebels and Counterculture. But John, whom I honestly consider one of, if not the most knowledgeable historians I know, is always being drawn into rabbit holes that have contributed not only to his ubiquitous mastery of history, but also has resulted in several other books and short works, including Toast of the Town, The Times of Sonny Wilson, for which he received an award of merit from the Historical Society and also made the Michigan Reads book list for 1999, which we will be discussing with him today. Welcome, John.
Hey, Chris. Good to talk to you today.
And I know you had a late night last night, like I. So I thank you for joining us this morning.
Yeah, coming up from Upper Peninsula back to here, so you know, can relate to your up north experience.
Yeah, it's always hard leaving Northern Michigan. Now, today we're going to concentrate primarily on one chapter in particular from your books on Sonny Wilson, the section on Idlewild, a summer resort in Michigan, which was possibly the most well-known and I think the largest resort for African Americans prior to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But there are many references and storylines in your book that fit into the theme we're going to be discussing more this season, which is the impact Northern Michigan has had on popular music. John, right. Let's start with how you met Sonny Wilson, who you describe as a very well-respected African-American Detroit business owner, and how you came to write Toast of the Town.
I was a graduate program at Wayne State University, and I was writing my master's thesis about Hastings Street, the famous African-American thoroughfare there that had black business and nighttime entertainment and that. And I was in the program with another black friend of mine, and he knew Sonny Wilson, and he knew I was writing that. Sonny Wilson had the Forest Club at Forest and Hastings, which was it's a fairly big place. He leased from 1941 to 51. He had a roller rink and a big long bar and all that. And the roller rink doubled as a nightclub with an entertainment spot. And he had a lot of bands in there. So Sonny was important for my study, and he said, well, I know. And so we went to Harold's Chop House, which was no longer there in Detroit, and we met. And Sonny liked me, and he wanted to write a book. I knew he knew Joe Lewis, and I knew that would sell the book. And by the time they left lunch, he called me about a week later and said, you know, do you want to write it? And then, you know, I figured, yeah, sure. I just started graduate school, and I needed a project. So I hung up with him, and 3 or 4 years, we worked on it, and I kept going to the library, checking everything. I wanted to be accurate. He was in the black newspaper quite often. So I knew that, you know, he had an outline, and I knew that Idlewild would be part of the book because he was, you know, up there all the time, and he formed the Detroit Idlewilders Club in 1952. So I knew that he was active up there, and we're talking about Idlewild, Michigan, which is just outside of Baldwin, the town of Baldwin in Lake County. It's about 70 miles from the Ludington area, you know, from Lake Michigan. So it was known for some nice lakes, and Lake Idlewild was, even in his time, was known for its real clear water in that Lake Idlewild. So I just knew that, you know, we got into this, I'd have to have a separate chapter. At one point, I even went up there, and he sent me up there to meet all these people. He was not feeling good at the time. He said, you go on up there, and I went up there with my wife and got a tour of the place in the early 90s. And so I went out on a boat in the Lake Idlewild, got shown around. And it certainly wasn't like it was, but it was real sedate, you know, and quiet at the time. And, oh, the locals showed me where the couple of the clubs were that we're going to talk about, and some of them where the hotels were. And that it settled down to be kind of a quiet place with some old, you know, old families live there now and that. But it was way past its heyday, but it was enjoyable. And so I had to learn all about it and trace it back to its origins of when it was founded. And was founded by actually white developers, the Branch Brothers and another man named Wilbur Lemon out of Chicago in around 1912, founded the Idlewild Resort Company. at the IRC with the express purpose of this resort. You're familiar, Chris, with the whole northern landscape there, deforested. You know, at one point, the lumber companies basically left the land that they got from the railroad companies, and a lot of the land right in that area, Lake County, was reverted back to the state. So the state was selling all this land off, and it's like, you know, for probably, I don't know, many dollars on the acre. And so the Branch brothers and Mr. Lemon got together and was buying acres and acres to make a resort for black folks. And they were pretty fair, because even the reminiscences of one of the first vacationers up there, W.E.B. Du Bois, who was the co-founder of NAACP and editor of the Crisis magazine, powerful figure in civil rights, early civil rights movement, you know, expressively said in many statements how the Branch brothers were pretty fair. They didn't rip off, you know, black folks, and he said they had the expertise. Now, how did they sell the land and to black folks? It's like they had that connection in Chicago with Mr. Lemon, and then they would advertise in various black magazines, Chicago Defender and Pittsburgh Courier and that, for the land, for purchase of lots and that. And some prominent black folks went up there, and they liked it, and they bought, you know, a lot of land. And W. Du Bois actually had a lot, but he never built anything on it. Other people invested in it were Madam C.J. Walker, the cosmetic giant, African-American woman. Dr. Hale Williams actually was the black surgeon from Chicago, the first surgeon to successfully, you know, carry out a heart open heart surgery procedure. He bought, until his death, he went up there and built a cottage, so he was very prominent. Charles Chestnut of Ohio, the black novelist and writer, he was another one of the early visitors. And so you had these, like, black, you know, very educated, what they would call the elites, with the black, other black folks called the elites, or, you know, the professionals, even upper middle class. And they liked its quietness. They built a clubhouse, and, you know, they had music we're going to get to here is our main thing. But at that point in the 20s and 30s, it was pretty quiet up there. There was no liquor license. The Club Paradise, you know, clubhouse would have, you know, society-like bands, and people went, these kind of people that were going there at that class level, some, you know, would probably have, you know, go to church, and they weren't the nighttime people that are going to be, we're going to be talking about that came about after the transformation after the Second World War. So it was a pretty quiet place, and, you know, a lot of folks liked it. Sonny went up there, I don't know when he first started going there, but he was pretty early on, and he might have gone up there like in the late 30s into the 40s. So he was there earlier and met many of the early founders of it, like Leland Herman Wilson, you know, were a couple that invested heavily and bought lots of land, and they built the clubhouse and made sure the road, you know, roads came in. Because originally it was an island with the Branch brothers. It just had foot bridges, and then they built auto bridges out of logs, and then that today it's all filled in. You wouldn't know it really was an island, because it's all filled in to the point where the entryways are all just filled in. Sonny went there pretty early on because he was a businessman in Detroit, so he went up there. But Sonny was one of the early people that weren't part of that educated elite. He mixed with them as a gentleman, but he was of the newer generation that was coming up, where their money was made in the nighttime. I call them the night people. Sonny was part of the night people. And by the time World War II ended, the land is being invested in several people who I mentioned that actually established the two big nightclubs. So it came too at the right time after the Second World War, where tastes and music were, you know, changing too. I mean, so Sonny was part of the nightclub promoter. He had the Forest Club. He knew lots of people. But there was a big mover and shaker, Arthur Braggs, out of Saginaw, born in Oklahoma and came to the Detroit area. And Saginaw was his home base. And the Wilsons had this Paradise Club, and he leased it in 1952 and put lots of money into it. He was a numbers man, a policy boss, whatever, you know. Sonny talks about the numbers in the book, tells the town how important they were to a black community in Detroit. Well, anywhere was a big urban black population, so Arthur Braggs had his numbers out of, you would bet a pretty number combination to the numbers runners, and they would, your number came up, they'd pay off that day. It was a pretty clean operation. People played it daily or weekly, so it brought in lots of money. Well, Braggs had his operation out of Bay City. He invested in the Paradise Club. He had lots of cash, so And he already was booking, you know, sports and entertainment around Bay City, and he had big connections in Detroit. He, 1952, he leased that building and put lots of money into it and refurbished it and made the Fiesta Room, which is around 200 and some seat concert, you know, concert and music spot, put lighting in. And what Braggs did is he wanted the Paradise to be on the level of what they would call a showcase room that would model itself after those in New York or Chicago, where you had an evening of entertainment where you actually drank and you ate in the club. So he had a chef and he came in, brought him up there, and he had people that he would hire for waiters and that. And it all had a certain element of class, which it did. And that was the same thing with Detroit, you know, Paradise Valley. All those clubs in Paradise Valley in the early days, in the 30s and 40s, you ate in the club, you had an evening. So up there, the same kind of model of entertainment, the show was, you know, was the same as it would be if you were in New York or Chicago, and those clubs in Detroit were modeled after those. And so what they would have is you would come there and you could eat, but the show had an MC. And then you would have the first part of the show, you'd have showgirls, and they would come and they were models, most of them dressed, you know, really elegantly, their hair all done. And this was all done by Sunny News. Vinnie Johnson was one of the promoters of that because he had a dance school in Detroit. So it was all choreographed, all really, really refined. And what they would do is the band would play, usually local bands, the backup band was from Detroit, like Choker Campbell, you know, not household names today, but good musicians with an ensemble of horns and all that out of Detroit. But women, the show girls up there were named the Fiesta Girls because of the Fiesta Room. And they would come out and they would gracefully walk around and show off their beautiful outfits and their beauty. They were very beautiful, of course. And they would walk the floor, the MC, now bring up the dancing girls. And they came to be known as the Braguettes. And they would do all sorts of really, really choreographed dances. And they would come off, and the MC would introduce the entertainment, the band, whether they had one or two people on the bill, depending on the evening. And that was the show, you know, and it was modeled after these review shows that went all the way back to like the 1930s. I mean, like in the Cotton Club and stuff like that, they would all have these elaborate lineups. So on a small scale, but on a very sophisticated scale, Braggs brought that up there, you know, that kind of entertainment. And then it got to the point, it got popular, and even, I'll talk about the second club, even white people were showing up.
That was a question I had for you, too, is were whites allowed at this time?
Yeah, and eventually into the mid-50s, into the 60s, until the end. There was some evenings they said there were more white people than black people on a certain evening, depending on it. No, they, like Sonny's club, you know, Sonny said one time he was at one of his clubs, and somebody asked him if they served white people, and he says, is this the United States of America? Come on in. So Sonny was always, you know, a businessman. He's like, oh, you know, I dealt in green, and if you're smart, you know what I mean, you cater to whoever walks in your door if they're decent people and behave and respect your spot. I had never read in any of the books or anything of any problem. I think anybody that went there expected it's going to be predominantly black, so you're not going to misbehave. I don't know if anybody had never any problems, really. I think that Sonny said there was a Pride in Baldwin still had places that wouldn't sell to black people, or the theater there wouldn't, and you know, allow blacks. And so they actually worked out through protest means and pressure on them. So there was some resentment, but there was never any outright hostility as far as anybody fighting or anything like that. I just didn't come across it, all the stuff that I've read about. But why would they want to go there? Because I'll tell you about the lineup. Braggs had the best lineup at the Paradise because he had the best connections, and he would go down to Detroit and he'd get a lot of the acts that were at the Flame Show Bar on John R., which was another showcase spot with the same setup. You had the MC and you had the complete lineup, and had his fingers in those, in a lot of different pies when it came to like promotion. He knew a lot of people. So he got some pretty good entertainment, and Detroit's producing some really great stuff at this time that were just starting out, but became world famous. So he got national acts, but he also got some really great younger people. One was, I can start at anybody on the list, but well, here's an interesting one, because Four Tops were up there, but they started out as the Four Ames, so they were not long out of high school. They went up to play at the Paradise and sang there. So Paradise gave people like that, young people, a good chance to have a house gig. You know how important that is, Chris, as a musician, that that's where you can groom your act every night and sing and play.
Just want to play
and work out songs. Yeah. So it wasn't just a place where people passed through. It was also, I always respect those places that, you know, like polish your act. Actually, it played a part in the development of the group. Not just you have one nighter there and, you know, you got your gig and you go. The Four Ames, and then they signed with Chess in 56. They became the Four Tops. Abdul Fikr just died, right? The last remaining one at 88.
Right.
Like a week or two ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of, if you know, in the news. But no, they were at Idlewild, and they were young. They just were not long out of high school when they first went up there. On the list, you can see Jackie Wilson. You know, Detroit's own Jackie Wilson. Phenomenal, right? He probably lit the place on fire, you know, the way he was. And I can go down the list. Bill Doggett, the organ player, had Honky Tonk, his favorite famous tune. The old guitar players, they had to learn that, too. Little Willie John, a Fever fame, you know, another great performer. Dinah Washington, Della Reese, who was at the Flame Show Bar, and, you know, was a hit there.
Some big names like that everybody would know, too, like Miles Davis, T-Bone Walker, right?
Miles wasn't there. I'm going to get the T-Bone, because this is what we got to watch in music. People put a lot of names on there, and I never saw anything advertised or anything like that. Now, we got to watch it, too, because I used to see a big, long laundry list, and it said Louis Armstrong. Yeah, well, Louis Armstrong went up there, but he didn't play there. He went there with Earl Hines to go out in a boat and relax. Even his memoir, he didn't go up there to play. He went up there to relax. You know? So Louis didn't play. No, he was a big star. He was playing giant theaters. He didn't need to play up there. A guy like Louis Armstrong needed to relax, too, where blacks could, you know, hang out and go out on boats and have a drink. You know what I mean? So, yeah, he was up there, but he didn't play. So sometimes I'll get to the list I know for sure. These people, there's pictures of them, and I see them on the I've seen their advertisements, so I know for sure all these folks I mentioned were there. Arthur Prysock, singer Arthur Prysock, B.B. King was there, and he married a woman in Detroit in 59, and he went up there and played, and he played the second place, I'm saying, too. Sometimes if they won't play the Paradise, I'm going to get the Flamingo in a minute that came after that. Jerry Butler, who was the singer with the Impressions and went off on his own. Roy Hamilton, the singer Roy Hamilton. Betty B. Bob Carter, another Detroit jazz singer. Brooke Benton. So these people, a young Aretha, you know, who was just starting out. So I'm saying these make sense because they were the people that had hits like Brooke Benton, but you could still get them for a gig up there because they had hits, but they weren't mega stars yet. Those people I know for sure. And I wrote an article for my friend's Blues Magazine back in, it was in 97. I wrote an article, T-Bone Walker and the Idaho Review. Now I'm going to get to the Idaho Review. T-Bone Walker, the great guitar player from Texas, one of my favorite guitar players.
Stormy Monday.
Stormy Monday. And what the Allman Brothers say, you know, live, you know, at the Fillmore. We're going to do a tune by Bobby Blueback. Well, actually, it's the T-Bone Walker song. Bobby Blueback, a great version of it. So T-Bone was a phenomenally influential Chuck Berry sound. You can hear the licks from T-Bone was one of his heroes. So, you know, T-Bone came up in the 30s and then had hits in the 40s, you know, during the war and stuff. He was great. T-Bone Walker being a bluesman, you know, he didn't have mega hit, you know, and everything. So you could put T-Bone. T-Bone played in Detroit a lot. He played it for Sonny, you know, a couple of times. He played on Hastings Street, the bars, and, you know, fairly decent-sized bars. He played at the Flame Show Bar. So T-Bone was in Detroit a lot. He was an easy guy to put on the bill. He stayed at Sonny's hotel, at a hotel, and he often stayed there. He was a friend of Sonny's. He was a guy you could book. And he was there quite often. But then in 1956, Bragg's put together the Idlewild Review, which is, you know, the name he gave to that complete package. It was so popular with this lineup that in the next year, 57, he took the Idlewild Review on the road. And he took it after the summer, and everybody went home, took back after the holiday was done, and everybody went back to school. They took and shuttered their cabins up and whatever. He took it on the road starting in 1957. And it lasted from 57 to 64, and the Review had that show, depending on who backed it, on the road. And it went to Detroit and played the Flame Show Bar. And in fact, they have an ad here in 62, T-Bone Walker in the Idaho Reviews at the Flame Show Bar in John Art. Well, yeah, but then they took it to all different cities. And I was amazed at the list of during its existence where it went. I know I'm getting out of up north here, but it shows you, like, how popular this was and what quality it was, because the Review went to Tulsa, Chicago, Boston, and different years, not always. It had to travel to Kansas City, Columbus, Indianapolis, went to Montreal and Toronto, went to New York and played the Apollo once, and the London Chop House in New York and played Dallas, Texas. You know, so it was pretty, getting pretty well known. and people were quite impressed. The reviews were quite good. So it was, again, they took a 30-person review that started up there during the summers until 64. So that Bragg's had quite an operation going. In 1955, another club opened called the Fiesta, the Flamingo, I'm sorry. And today I went in the Flamingo. The Paradise was gone when I went there. All I saw was an empty lot when I went up there, unfortunately. But the Flamingo was opened by another entrepreneur who had hotels and everything by the name of Phil Giles. And Phil Giles opened the Flamingo Club. It wasn't as big or as fancy as the Paradise, but I went in there and it was empty, but they had like, Flamingo had like a, on the wall, it had a tropical scene still there and that. And today they put a marker, a state marker in front of it. A group is trying to get it back to restore it and that, and at least get it so people can visit and go in. I was just let in by, you know, by the locals. So to peer in there, you couldn't go in there because it was shuttered basically. But they're working on that. The Flamingo wasn't as extensive. It had more comedians and stuff and dancers and that, but like sometimes a performer might go over to the Flamingo and play there after. And I guess they had a pretty symbiotic relationship, but a lot of the sources say that they were kind of, you know, trying to compete with one another. They were trying to just get as many people as they could up there and fill the seats. You'd probably go to Flamingo one night and go sit. And at the Flamingo too, comedians like George Kirby would play there as well. So there's people on the bill up there who also became pretty famous comedians, you know, too. And so the Flamingo was good, like Sonny said, good show, but not anything you'd see in Vegas and that, but it was another outlet for, you know, entertainment, not some heavy as the music, but they had a lot of dancers, I noticed, and that. So this is an era too before, you know, the 60s come with a 5-band review show, and they, you know, like that would come to the Fox with all the, you know, just one after another. They still had all these MCs and, you know, informal kind of a setting, which was going to go away, you know, in the 60s and replaced with, you know, different kind of production that was probably seen by a younger generation and older setup, you know, with all the showgirls and all that, that would disappear. And like Motown would turn their acts into showgirls, really, you know what I mean? They would groom them and they became the dancing acts, you know, themselves. And Gordy had that genius of putting that together, you know, the dancing and the singing. So tastes were going to change too. And by 1964 with the Civil Rights Act, it opened up venues from all over. You could go to Florida, Vegas, and people started going, even to black folks started going to the islands, right? And that Rags eventually just kind of pulled his operation out of there about that same time. And after the Paradise was no longer what it was, it faded in. So they tried a couple of people, but the heyday of the music was over and the people started like dwindling away, except for the old elite guard that maybe they still had their homes there. And it's funny because when I went up there, they talked about the old, you know, the older folks that never went to those bars, you know, that kind of, you know, they begrudgingly had to deal with it. But a lot of them didn't really care for the night people, you know, and Sonny was a decent guy, but they knew Bragg was a numbers man, you know, and so the old guard was fading away and got older. And then finally, then that kind of the phase of the post-war era died around mid-60s. So it kind of became a quiet place again. You know, I have to remember too, during the 20s and 30s and most of the 40s, there were no liquor licenses. So Sonny worked to get the liquor licenses after the Second World War.
Yeah, that's the question I had for you too, is the liquor. So what's going on here during, because we have so many different incarnations of the and eras of the resort there. Mentioned, it starts out.
It was dry. Yeah, it was dry for all the way until after the post-war. And Sonny tried to get, you know, work politically. I think even to get more liquor licenses. And I think it was Soapy Williams. I think it was Anna Williams that he worked with, and his wife tried to get
Soapy Williams. You
liquor
said?
License. Yeah, I think he worked with them to try to get, you know, I don't know how many liquor licenses were allowed. They had after hours places up here too, by the way, the El Morocco and that. Those were all up under the radar. You know, I'm not saying nobody drank there from the 20s on, but there were no liquor licenses, so there was no open nightclubs anyway. You know, you couldn't have one; they'd shut you down. Somebody'd find out. So the crowd that was there was very sophisticated in the early days, and they weren't heavy drinkers, so there was no demand. But those that wanted to drink the men and play cards, they went off to their little spots, like you do at any resort. You know, probably smoked and drank, did what everybody else does in any other resort. So, but these clubs wouldn't have flourished without the liquor licenses. So, you know, that's another story in itself. It's not clear in the academic books, but Sonny didn't give me the years. But, you know, he worked to get liquor licenses for the clubs and maybe for some of the hotels. But
yeah, and
was another.
In your book, you say possibly liquor's coming in illegally from Baldwin, possibly, which was a wild frontier, 26 saloons or so going at that time. You think with these juke joints, because some of them are kind of, would you refer to them as juke joints, the after-hours activities that were going on there?
No, these were, it was a family resort, so it was kind of like, it was all above ground, you know. The Paradise was just a fairly, you know, decent place. They weren't like that. It's just, you know, it was... It was hard, too, because Sonny was talking about the reluctance of some of the white people in Baldwin to sell anything to black folks. So I don't think that their liquor was supplied very much from them until later. Sonny, you know, the grocery store sometimes denied them, you know, selling them anything. The theater wouldn't let them in, but eventually they did. I think all that booze was brought from, you know, they trucked it up in their own, you know, they didn't get a supply, I don't think, from Baldwin. That was all. Wherever they got it. See, this is the thing. It's hard in history, and you know, you do the prohibition tours and all that. This is part of this is an underground economy.
Yeah, this
Bragg
is
an underground guy. These are people that don't leave letters and stuff. They
no, this is a documented history. they're not documenting
right,
this.
Right. Sonny was part of what I call the night people. The nighttime people, you know, just like when I wrote about Black Detroit, there were a lot of people I talked to. They said, oh, we didn't go. We knew about that, but we worked. And we went to church on Sunday. We didn't go to the nightclubs. My dad didn't go. You know, those were the night people. Sonny's whole existence was the night people. The numbers, he wasn't a numbers man, but his friends were numbers men. They stayed up. They had nightclubs. You know, they entertained famous people in the kingdom, like Jackie Gleason was his friend. These are the nighttime people. And outside of, like, you know, Sonny leaving some reminiscences or what he gets in the paper, you know, they don't leave paper trails. Numbers men don't, you know, these are considered gangsters by many straight people. And they didn't approve of some of that crowd, but they were men that dressed real well, you know, fine and all that, gave themselves, but their source of money and their, you know, they ever come from an economy that, you know, and a whole other set of rules than a lot of people that, you know, that were the original founders of the place. But yeah, that's what I'm trying to tell people. They try to look all this up. I said, you know, so many new gangsters, they don't leave paper trails.
You've been listening to Tales of Northern Michigan's Past. I'm Christopher Struble, inviting you to join us next time as we continue our conversation with author John Cohassie and his perspective on Idlewild, the famous African-American summer enclave.